My fingers are blistered and bleeding. There's no longer discomfort that you brought. That's Alexis on Fire. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Fingers, the talk of the day down at Rogers Center yesterday. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. on the heater to end all heaters, a franchise record. Well, the franchise record ended Sunday, six straight games with multiple RBI, but he was named American League Player of the Week yesterday. He had six home runs in his last nine games. A lot going well, 20 RBI in that stretch as well. A lot going well for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But on Sunday, he took a Garrett Cole pitch off of his fingers. He was a late scratch from yesterday's game. Had a little bit of discomfort still squeezing the bat, as you'd expect after taking 96 off the fingers. I have not taken 96 or even 86 off the fingers. Sounds like it would really, really hurt. Anyway, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. comes out of the lineup as a late scratch, and all the offense comes out of the lineup with him. Apparently, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa was also a late scratch in that game with a knee issue that popped up during pregame stretching. So a bit of a weird one. They were also without Danny Jansen, who's on the paternity list. So a thinned out team that hasn't scored a ton of runs in the first place, then loses some of their most productive bats and faces one of the hottest pitchers in baseball in Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown absolutely shuts them down over six innings, just two hits, three walks, strikes out five. So the Blue Jays lose 3-1. They did manage a ninth inning garbage time home run from Ernie Clement. Garbage time is maybe not fair. It was a save situation. You homer off Josh Hader, you get a gold star in your game rundown. The Jays missed bigger opportunities than in the ninth inning, though. In the second inning, in the first inning, really, we could go back to they had the pitch count way up. Spencer Horwitz worked a tremendously long plate appearance. You're thinking at that point, at least, well, nothing came of it, but we got Hunter Brown's pitch count up early. We got to see him a lot. Maybe, you know, we could chase him by the fifth. Maybe this helps the next guys through. And there was some evidence that maybe that was right, because in the second inning, the Jays managed to load the bases with only one out. Unfortunately, Ernie Clement popped up to first. Kevin Kiermaier strikes out, and then Hunter Brown really settled in. The Jays would get nothing from there for quite a while. The Astros didn't get much either, though. Yariel Rodriguez turned in his best start in his young major league career. He went 6 2/3 innings. He hadn't gone longer than four innings in a start yet, so some pitch efficiency helping him out there. Only needed 83 pitches to get into the seventh inning. Only gave up two hits and two walks, both of the walks coming in the seventh inning. Got a double play to get out of one of them. Trevor Richards it stranded the inherited runner in the other. Unfortunately for Yariel Rodriguez, one of the hits he gave up was a solo shot to Pena, and that was enough for him to leave the best start of his career down 1-0. Jays get another opportunity in the eighth in this one. Addison Barger pinch hits for Kevin Kiermaier, draws a walk. Bo Bichette has a real bad strikeout. We'll talk to Joe Siddle about that a little later, but chases a ball-to-ball slider in an 0-2 count for strike three there. And then Spencer Horwitz sends a laser down the right field line for a double. The Jays decide not to send Addison Barger and test old Trey Cabbage, three lettuce out in right field. And then Justin Turner gets hit by a pitch. Bases loaded, one out again. But George Springer with kind of a soft line out, and then Dalton Varsho grounds out as well. So they get out of that. The Jays managed nothing until the Ernie Clement solo homer. And Yordan Alvarez had added some insurance runs at that point on a two-run home run against Zach Pop. So Jays lose 3-1. Not a lot of offense there. Fun day down at the park, result notwithstanding. It was Canada Day, of course. There was a lot going on. There were the Jamie Campbell outfits. There were everyone in red, the red jerseys that we think are the jerseys from last year, and they just didn't bother Fanatics for a new set of jerseys that they'll only use once. There was also a cool part of the Canada Day celebration where the Blue Jays had 24 new Canadian families come in to the ballpark and be a part of those pregame ceremonies. It's something that our guest, Julia Kreutz, wrote about for BlueJays.com, for MLB.com. She joins us now. Julia, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me on. Like, I know it's been a while, so happy to be back.
Yeah, happy to see you down at the park recently. Running into you on the subway. You can't get rid of me now that you're back. How was yesterday? How did you enjoy the Canada Day celebration side of things?
Yeah, it was definitely, just a fun day overall. It ends up being a little bit of a longer day for us, I feel like, but it is so worth it, right? Because it's, it's special to see just the pride that people come in with and everything that the team puts into it as well. And, you know, this year, even the ownership group getting involved, the citizenship ceremony was an initiative from Rogers. And that is why, you know, last year they did it with 6 people. This year they did it with 24. So we can see that there's an impetus. There is this will to not only keep growing the game and the fan base, but also to offer, to show really what is it that Canada has to offer in a larger scale. So that was very rewarding.
So you got to write about that great piece over at BlueJays.com. You got to talk to some of those families, some great insight from Hazel May as well. She was a part of that. She is, of course, immigrated to Canada as a 7-year-old from the Philippines. You are a newer Canadian citizen as well. How meaningful was it for you to get to tell that story and speak to those families yesterday?
Yeah, it was. I'm not a kid, I'm not a citizen yet.
Oh, sorry.
we'll see how it happens moving forward. I am a permanent resident, and that to me was extremely. You know, this journey is so long for so many of us, and there are so many steps that go into it. And with every kind of touchstone, you sort of, you know, it's a new victory. But for these families, it's the culmination of this process. It's people that have been here for 5-7 years, grinding it out, unsure really of what is going to happen in their future. And at the same time, they're taking in the culture of where they are. They're taking in the sports and the music and the diversity of the people. And just to see the emotion and to see that happen at the ballpark, to me was very special, because not only is this now, you know, something that they're going to remember for the rest of their lives, it is also a direct link to sport, and really just, I guess it's a testament to what sport can represent to people from everywhere. So yeah, that was definitely a special one for me.
Apologies for dropping the ball on the difference between permanent resident and citizen there. I guess we won't get Julia Kreutz running for mayor just yet, or premier or anything like that. Yeah,
couple years.
We'll
see what happens.
Very nice to have you as a permanent resident, of course. And I guess as you're talking to those families, like a little extra special for the Brazilian family that you got to speak to and get the dust off the Portuguese for a little bit.
It's funny because I went straight to them, right? I don't know why exactly. We kind of just know that they're there, and just the emotion that they were showing. I thought, okay, this is the family that I'm going to talk to. And, you know, 2 sentences in, we kind of realized that we could speak in Portuguese. And that was like, oh, me too. That's great. Congrats. And it ended up being also a very meaningful interview, and one that, you know, went on so many different directions, so many fun directions, and really added a lot of color and a lot of insight to my story. So yeah, that was, and again, you know, a family that had never been to Rogers Center, had never watched a live baseball game, and now they're there and they're watching, and they're going to have this moment to remember. And who knows, maybe we're adding some diverse fans to the Blue Jays as well.
And really cool to hear Hazel speak as well in your story about what it means for her to not only have come for the Philippines and become a citizen at 7 years old, but to now be one of the faces of baseball in this country for, you know, the next generation of Hazel Mays or newer Canadians who are coming to baseball as well.
Yeah, she's an inspiration, right, Blake? I think you and I can agree on that. It fills me with pride, really, to see someone like Hazel have the success that she's had. And it made me feel when I was starting out that my dreams were possible. And I hope that we can continue that as well, not only as women, but as women of color and as immigrants. So, you know, really just everything that Canada Day should be about, I feel like we lived at the ballpark yesterday.
And then there was the baseball, which unfortunately this conversation is going to take a hard steer downhill here. The Jays losing that one 3-1. So yes, a very fun day. A lot of positives in there. A terrific story from you. We are going to pivot now to the baseball. I know you're on the Astros side of this series. You were on the Jays side on the weekend, so you've got a nice little look at both of these teams. Before we get into the specifics of the game, at a high level, a couple weeks ago, these teams were in an almost identical spot. Big payroll. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be competing this year. Your stars are underperforming a little bit. You're far out of the wild card in the division, but there's too much time left. you still have time to get it together before the trade deadline. And what we've seen is the Blue Jays keep on exactly as they were, and the Houston Astros now win 10 of 11 to get back not only in the wild card race, but the American League West race. Can you sense the difference, like having been around those two teams over the last couple of days here? Like, is there a different feeling between what those teams are going through and where they are right now?
Yeah, that's been really, really fascinating to see, because, you know, we kind of watched John Schneider say a few times that while the bullpen is depleted and maybe, you know, some starters are running into some difficulties a little bit earlier in the game, you need other guys to step up. And for the most part, that hasn't really happened for the Blue Jays. I think with the exception of Yennis Cabrera, who has been pitching pretty well out of the bullpen in a spot that maybe we wouldn't have expected to see him as much. The guy stepping up is something that is still missing for the Blue Jays. Whereas the Astros have had those guys step up. Hunter Brown is in a pretty amazing run right now after starting the year out pretty badly. Same goes for Ronel Blanco, a guy that we didn't expect to make the Astros rotation, and who now all of a sudden is one of their best starters, vying for an all-star spot, probably. So this is what you look at. Kyle Tucker on the offensive side, he's been out for a month. He was their best hitter early on when they were doing badly, and they're playing well without him. They're winning games without him. So it's that factor that I believe is missing. It's those guys stepping up, and then the stars doing their part as well. You saw it with Yordan Alvarez's home run yesterday. How important are those tack on runs? How important is it to keep going and to, you know, build on the lead, even though your offense is struggling, and hitting the pitches that are there for you to hit? Jeremy Peña got a middle hanging breaking ball, and he did what he's supposed to do with that, right? And the Blue Jays, more often than not this year, have not. So there have been a few factors, I think, that have sort of differentiated these two clubs over the past few weeks, even though they were in a very, very similar position, just a month and a half ago. The good news is that the Blue Jays still have time to figure that out, to go on a run like the Astros did. But it does get harder pretty much every day at this point.
Yeah, and you are, you know, kind of running out of time, because obviously, you know, end of September is when you got to make up the ground in the standings to make the playoffs. But end of July is probably when you've got to make up the ground in the standings for this front office to not sell, which obviously we spoke to Ross Atkins about last week. We'll talk a ton about over the course of the next month. Lots of trade slop coming on the show over the next couple weeks. But yeah, the Jays are 8 games out of a wild card spot with a bunch of teams to jump. It would have to happen now if it's ever going to happen. Julia, you mentioned Hunter Brown. I know you wrote after the game about Hunter Brown's performance. He's been like this remarkable turnaround after an off, like it looked like he was headed back to the minor leagues, had an ERA up around 6. He's been tremendous lately. What did he have to say after the game, or what were the Astros saying about that ability to kind of turn his season around in May there?
Yeah, it's you kind of saw maybe a little bit of the evolution of Hunter Brown during that game yesterday, because it wasn't smooth sailing by any means. He ran into trouble, especially in the second inning with the bases loaded, like you recapped at the start of the show, Blake. And he made the pitches that he needed to make. And what Joe Espada, the Astros manager, mentioned post-game is that it wasn't really about locking in or anything like that. It was just about trusting himself and trusting the defense behind him. He threw his sinker, which is a new pitch for him. He threw it a lot more than he usually does against the Blue Jays. This is a lineup we know that doesn't necessarily offer a ton of swings and misses. Strikeouts are kind of here or there for the Blue Jays. And he said, okay, so I'm just going to go to my sinker, play it off of the cutter, play it off of the four-seamer, and maybe get some awkward swings, some soft contact. And we see that in pop-outs and ground-outs and whatnot. So that was pretty impressive to see from a young guy. And that is what he's been doing of late to go on this run. He has a sub 0.3 ERA, I believe, over his past 6 starts or 5 starts, which is pretty tremendous. And you can't take anything away from him, obviously. This is his run and it's his success. We also saw, I think, a little bit of a pressing quality to the Blue Jays at bats, especially after that second inning, swinging very early in counts. And so it allowed Brown to sort of get his pitch count back in order and pitch another quality start, his eighth straight, which is pretty unbelievable. That is what I saw. I think that it was a little bit of him just making the adjustment and the Blue Jays maybe pressing a little too much, going after those first pitches or second pitches in the at-bats, not working the count and getting some pretty awkward swings.
Yeah, it's well said there. And yeah, the Jays, you know, the pitch count got so high so early over that first and second inning. The first inning, Spencer Horwitz had like a 37 pitch plate appearance. And it kind of, it really does. I pulled the numbers on this in the middle of the game yesterday because it's fascinating to me that the Jays have some of, like, you get through the Horwitz Turner part of the order and everyone's so patient, everything takes so long. And then you get like Clement at the bottom of the order, Kiermaier at the bottom of the order, and then Bo at the top of the order when it turns back over. And I looked, and the Jays have minimum 70 plate appearances. The Jays have seven guys in the top 100 for pitches per plate appearance. So seven, and one of those is Vogelbach. Mm-hmm. So, like, this obviously doesn't mean you have to take a lot of pitches to have success. But seven guys in the top 100, that's a lot of patient guys who work long plate appearances. And then they have three of the bottom 20 in Ernie Clement, IKF, and Bo Bichette. So really contrast of styles throughout the lineup. Yeah. And yeah, a tough day for Bo Bichette there. You know, Ernie Clement, the homer late, but the pop out with the bases loaded, one out in that second inning you mentioned. So tough one for the offense again, with no Vlad and no IKF and no Danny Jansen. On the pitching side, Yariel Rodriguez took, that's as tough luck a loss as you're going to get, really. You give up just one run over 6 2/3 innings. Julia, by far the best we've seen from Yariel Rodriguez. What did you like from his outing? What did you see from him out there? Because, I mean, you mentioned the pitch count stuff with Hunter Brown. Yariel only needing 83 pitches to get deep into the seventh was unexpected.
Yeah, I have to say, I was a little surprised that he got pulled there. I think that he, more than anything, deserved to finish that inning because of how he was pitching. And, you know, just again, talking to the Astros afterwards, everyone was so respectful of what Rodriguez did. Espada was the first to say that the pitch mix was really, really unbelievable. He was locating everything yesterday, right? That curveball is so good, save for the one that he left hanging to Peña. And then just plays off of other stuff. And he does things maybe to like lefty hitters that you wouldn't expect him to do. He pitches in ways that aren't necessarily what you would expect based on the situation. And that is going to throw guys off balance. Now, this was the first time that the Astros were facing Rodriguez. And so expect them to make adjustments moving forward if they face him again. But what we saw was just tremendous command of all of his pitches, which is a 5 or 6 pitch mix there, and confidence. And you know, there's just a team that didn't really know what to do with what Rodriguez had to offer. And let's not forget that this is a guy that, you know, pitched in Cuba and then he went to Japan and pitched in Japan, and you can really see that in his mechanics and his delivery. It's just an awkward at bat. It just is. And it's probably going to be for as long as he's in the league, if he doesn't tweak too much. That's what we saw from the Astros yesterday. Again, a really good lineup, a lineup that's been clicking of late. They've been doing really, really well. But it was kind of fun to just, you know, see the level of respect and the hint of confusion of like, how did we get this bamboozled?
And I mean, that, I think that's part of like, Yariel's been interesting guy to analyze. One, because like, you know, you come off the IL and it's only 1 1/3 inning, and then your next start gets rained out, and like, so already we're like working with incomplete games. He was in the minors for a little bit, but then you dig in and it's like, okay, well, when you factor in like the different leg kicks, the different arm angles and stuff, like, how am I supposed to evaluate a fastball that he throws like 3 or 4 different ways?
I don't know,
he's fascinating. I love the intensity too, like, you know, he has that kind of gamer feel to him on the mound and even off the mound, like even in the locker room on a non-pitching day, he seems that intense. Have you had a chance to talk to him much yet? I know you were on Astros for
not yet, but I will say this, observing him is fun as well, right? Especially when he does well. Seeing the intensity, it's something that I guess we just look for as reporters. You know, we want to get to know a guy, and chatting, like scrumming a guy post game, isn't necessarily the best way to get a feel for their personality and to get a feel for their drive. And so, you know, when he gets off the mound and, you know, tips his hat to the crowd and you can see how much fun he's having, I think that to me really states where Rodriguez is. And like you said, Blake, he's run into some adversity already. You know, it's a, this major league stint has just started, but there's been quite a bit of adversity for him and as early as his return from the IL. So you can really see that he is focused and he's dead set on having success in this league and on being that fifth starter that the Blue Jays so desperately need. And so when you see him have fun on top of that, that is kind of a good omen in my mind. It's a good sign. It's really a shame that the offense couldn't pick him up because he definitely, definitely didn't deserve a loss yesterday.
Yeah, it was great and hopefully a lot to build on. You know, you look at, you know, the pitch efficiency side of things, 83 pitches to go into the seventh inning. That had been probably the biggest issue in his earlier starts and his AAA starts. Maybe this gives him the confidence of, hey, I can stay in the zone. I can locate everything. These guys can't make good contact with it except for Peña there. You know, even the double wasn't like, you know, the greatest hit double of any or of all time or anything like that. And then, yeah, you mentioned it. Not only they need the fifth starter, they needed length from him yesterday because I don't know what a bullpen day would have looked like if with the shorter Yari out. Like Bowden Francis had pitched three of the prior 4 days. Jose Quas had pitched 2 days in a row straight up from the minors. Nate Pearson had pitched a lot. So I don't even know, had he only gone four like he'd done in the earlier starts, I don't even know what that would have looked like. So great for him. I do hope you get to talk to him sometime soon. You guys can do the change in and out of languages things because I think he speaks three or four languages as well because of his baseball journey. Okay, so part of the reason the offense had nothing was because Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was out. And you wrote a great piece on him on the weekend with a quote from IKF about how he's our pilot. And at that point, he had had six straight multi-RBI games. He didn't do that Sunday, but we still look at like 20 RBI over the last nine, six home runs. He was out yesterday, but and I have to ask this with the caveat because there's some part of the audience who will inevitably be like, who cares? They're not going to win enough games and whatever. We're still going to talk about the baseball. What does it mean lineup when Vlad gets hitting like that? Like this team, even if it's not going to make up eight games in the wild card, it really did feel like a more functional lineup 1-9 just on the basis of Vlad getting going.
Yeah, you know, you look at the ability to get on base from a guy like IKF, the ability to get on base from a guy like Spencer Horwitz, and what the Blue Jays are trying to build here are those big innings, right? It's important to tack on after the big innings, but you know how much of a jolt you get from a three-run frame, let's say. So that is what Vladdy offers. It's those crooked numbers. I think that the Blue Jays have been sort of tinkering and trying to construct a more balanced lineup so that guys like Vladdy and to a lesser extent Bo can come in and put those crooked numbers on the board and drive in those runs. And that is what we saw during that span. It's not just that Vladdy just caught fire. It's that the lineup before and after him was putting him in a good position to drive in those runs and to hit for power and to just be himself and to be his best self, let's put it like that, and what he has best to offer for the Blue Jays. So it's obviously, you know, credit to him, but it's also seeing that the Blue Jays lineup did finally start to click at the same time, which is also something that IKF mentioned during that interview. It's that they are seeing extremely good signs from himself, from Justin Turner, from George Springer, who had a terrible start to the season and now is starting to look like himself again a little bit. You know, Bo could be next. We don't know. But and then you add a guy like, say, a Spencer Horwitz, who was hitting everything in AAA, came in and hit everything in the majors, and now he's starting to cool down, but he still has that on-base ability to offer. The Blue Jays are a better lineup for it. And Vladdy is seeing the success of that as well and is being the difference maker as we expect him to be. It's also good, Blake, to see that that's still in there, the ability to, you know, hit home runs in three straight games and pick up all the RBIs and make his OPS soar. That is all still there, which is a very, very good news for the Blue Jays. We saw he was not himself at all earlier in the year. Not even the batting average was there, right, in April. And then that came back in May. And so to see the power come back late last month Hopefully he is not sidelined for long due to the fingers issue there. But yeah, it just makes the Blue Jays lineup excel on a different level when Vladdy is hitting like that.
A little too on the nose for this season to right during Vlad's hot streak, have him get hit on the hands. And you mentioned IKF, best quote on the team and one of their better overperforming hitters. And both those guys get scratched on the same day on short notice. A little too on the nose for what we've dealt with here in 2024.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely unfortunate. And it's part of why the Blue Jays are in the situation that they're in. It takes a lot for a major league ball club to click, to just get in sync, everything at the same time. There are a lot of moving parts to a major league club. And it is unfortunate to see both of these guys get scratched when things seem to be turning around. At the same time, there's reason to believe that maybe it won't be, especially for Vlad, it won't be a long issue. Hopefully it won't, because honestly, it's more fun to watch when things are going a little bit better than they did early on. So yeah, you know, you kind of saw it with the Astros early on too. It's a tough one. Injuries are going to mount and guys are going to go on slumps, and it's going to happen. And it takes more than the 26 on the roster for a team to have success.
So, Julia, you kind of said it earlier with this Astros team that they're proof that you actually can go on a run and get back into it a little bit. They've won 10 of 11. They're now only 3 games out of the final wild card and out of the AL West. The Jays have an even bigger hole here at 8 games behind the final wild card. So they have 23 games before the deadline. The answer is probably overly simplistic, but what do the next couple weeks have to look like for us not to be spending August, September doing stories like, hey, get to know this guy out of AAA or out of AA, or that came over in a trade, you know, that filling the last 2 months of the season for us?
You have to win series, Blake. And I think that is what's missing here, right? It's the Blue Jays show flashes of greatness, but closing it out has been extremely difficult, and you have to go on those big runs. The Astros are where they are, or even look at the Mets. You know, it's because they have won a healthy string of games. That is obviously easy to say and extremely hard to do. I understand, especially when the bullpen is as depleted as it is right now, especially when you can't necessarily count on Kevin Gausman, who's still figuring some stuff out, was very honest about where his splitter is this year after his last start, especially when he has not been the ace that the Blue Jays expected him to be this year. Yusei Kikuchi has been very, very good, but you know, you kind of can't really trust that he's going to give you deep outings. So there are so many question marks there. The Blue Jays need the guys to step up. And if they do, they will be capable of going on those big runs. I believe that there's still time. I honestly do, but it does get harder every day.
It certainly does. And it's one thing to try to close the gap by the end of September, another to try to close it enough by the end of July where you're not sellers there. Julia, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Great job on that piece about Canada Day and the new Canadian citizens yesterday. And it's been great to see you down at the park again.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Julia Kreutz of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Make sure you go read that piece and check out a little bit more about what the Blue Jays did yesterday as part of their Canada Day celebrations for some of those new Canadian families. It was a lot of fun to be down there, results aside. Speaking of Canadian results, Joey Votto got his first hit on his rehab assignment yesterday. Also stole a base. Some people are going to have to give away some shirts because of promises made on Twitter for that one. Not me. I have no shirts to give away anyway. But Joey Votto continues to work down at Dunedin. Doesn't seem like that's anything imminent, given that was his first hit. Good sign for comfort level, probably, that he stole a base. Still just playing a couple days a week down there. Ricky Tiedemann, by the way, going to make his latest rehab start at that same level tomorrow. And then the big news today is that Jordan Romano is seeing Dr. Keith Meister today to get an extra opinion on that elbow that he's been shut down with due to soreness multiple times. The only other update coming out of yesterday, Jimmy Garcia felt good off a mound Sunday. He's going to throw off a mound again tomorrow and see how that goes. And then, Jansen on the paternity list for probably at least a couple days here, and we'll get Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. updates a little later. Injuries mounting, it's something the Jays haven't dealt with a ton this year. It's something the Houston Astros have dealt with a ton this year. Let's take a break. Let's take a closer look inside this Astros streak of winning 10 of their last 11 with Robert Ford, the radio play-by-play voice of the Astros. He's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. There have been 39 winning streaks in Major League Baseball this year that went five games or longer. Zero of those belong to the Toronto Blue Jays. The Toronto Blue Jays haven't had like a long, meaningful winning streak in a handful of years here. We got to go back to like 2017, 2018. The Houston Astros have had a couple. They flirted with one in May. Then they recently put up seven in a row, lost one game, and are right back to it here. They took two of three against the Mets on the weekend. They beat the Toronto Blue Jays in the opener here. They've gone 10-1 over their last 11 to get firmly back in the playoff picture. The voice of those Astros on the radio side, Robert Ford, joins us now. Robert, how are you doing, man? How did you enjoy the Canada Day festivities yesterday?
I'm doing well, and I really enjoyed the Canada Day festivities. First time I've ever been in Canada for Canada Day. And, yeah, I enjoyed all the pageantry. I thought it was really, really cool, and it was just great to see, even outside the ballpark, everybody just so excited and, you know, in such a good mood. Really, really cool, and I'm glad that I was able to be here.
You also got the people at Immaculate Grid gave us a nice pull yesterday with some CanCon and some Blue Jays stuff. Nice pull on your part with Damaso Garcia in the Jays and All-Star Square, man.
Yeah. So that's, and with Immaculate Grid, since I do it every day, there's some people you just kind of file away, especially for All-Stars or Gold Gloves that you can pull out. Like Bill Dolly is one I like to, or Ken Dolly rather is one I like to pull out for the Astros All-Star back in 1983. You know, it's kind of good to have some of those in your back pocket. You never know when you need them.
Yeah. It's I mean, that's the name of the game, right? Is how much nonsense can you stick away? You know, there were the Jays in 2013 had a middle reliever named Steve Delabar make the All-Star team. That's a sneaky
right.
One there as well. They did a raise the bar campaign to get him in there. Astros are red hot here, Robert. They've won 10 of 11. You have called, you know, you've been on that broadcast since 2013. So you've called through the rebuilding Astros and then the contending Astros. How different was it at the first part of this season when to have this Astros club with playoff and championship aspirations struggle so much early on?
I mean, it was obviously frustrating, especially for the fan base. Because, you know, you knew that the ability should be in there. It just wasn't showing up on the field. Now, injuries certainly have had a lot to do with it. I mean, even now the Astros have five starting pitchers on the injury list, and that's always going to hurt you. But injuries happen to every team. But it just seemed to exacerbate, especially on the pitching side, how little starting pitching depth the Astros have, pretty thin as it is right now. That was a big part of it. Also, the offense just was not performing very well. Alex Bregman got off to a very slow start. Yordan Alvarez was hit or miss early. And so, you know, those things were definitely problematic. It was kind of frustrating to see the team get off to the start that it did, especially since that isn't something that's been seen in Houston for a while.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating from afar, and I mentioned it earlier in the show. The Jays and Astros were kind of in the same spot a couple weeks ago, you know, underperforming, had big aspirations for the season. Yes, some injury stuff or some other stuff, but you could still, you know, the expectations were still there. And the Astros have been able to turn this around where the Blue Jays haven't. What has clicked the last 2 weeks here or so for this Astros team? Obviously, you know, there's still a long list of guys on that injury list, a bunch of the pitchers you named, Kyle Tucker still on the IL, but they've been able to steer out of it here and play some pretty good baseball the last couple of weeks. What's changed or clicked for them?
I think the biggest things are the pitching has gotten a lot better. Early in the year, the bullpen, the back end of the bullpen, you know, they signed Josh Hader to add with Ryan Pressly and Brian Abreu. And, you know, that's the seventh, eighth, ninth group. All three of them struggled to start the year. And now all three of them have been pitching very well. So that has turned around, and you figured that they would get better. It was just kind of a fluky thing. I mean, you know, it's one thing when you have three really good relievers for one to struggle or even two to struggle at the same time, but all three, I mean, that usually doesn't happen. And all three have righted the ship in that regard. Also the starting pitching, even with all the injuries, has gotten a lot better. Hunter Brown has been outstanding. He pitched yesterday, you know, his, eighth straight quality start after he got off to a really rough start. Spencer Arrighetti's coming off a great outing against the Rockies his last time out, seven shutout innings, striking out 10. He's someone who's gotten better as the season has progressed. Ronel Blanco has been good all year long. He's been a very pleasant surprise. Of course, as you know, threw a no-hitter against the Blue Jays in his first start of this year. But, yeah, I mean, I think the pitching has gotten a lot better. And also, early in the year, I mean, all season, the Astros, when you look at all the offensive categories, OPS, runs per game, things like that, they were at or near the top third of baseball in those categories, but they weren't winning games. And I think a lot of that came down to, it seemed like this team was just really struggling to get the big hit, get that hit with runners in scoring position, score runs late when you needed to. And those things have turned around of late as well.
This is maybe at risk of oversimplifying here, but how much of that on the offensive side feels like it comes down to that in April and May, Yordan Alvarez was just regular good. And since the calendar kind of turned to June and now July, he's been playing like an MVP again at the dish there. How much of this comes down to, you know, Alvarez has really clicked and really started to look like the Yordan Alvarez we've come to expect the last couple of years?
I think that's part of it. But I also think the fact that Alex Bregman has started to swing the bat better over the last month. I mean, he was basically an out for the first 2 months of the season, but has really turned things around over the last month or so. I think that has really made a difference. Yiner Diaz had been kind of up and down. He's been swinging the bat a lot better. And keep in mind, all this has been happening, as you mentioned, Kyle Tucker. He's been out for a month, and the offense has had their best month of the season in June and had the best record in baseball in June with Kyle Tucker only playing two games in the month. So, and Kyle Tucker, you know, I mean, he's probably going to be on the All-Star team because that's how good he was before he got hurt. So, yeah, I think a lot of guys stepping up. Yeah, you're right. Alvarez getting better has helped, but it hasn't just been him.
Yeah, that's a good thing for this Astros team, and the Kyle Tucker absence. I mean, it's more, even more impressive to me that they've been able to do this without a guy who was their best hitter before he went down. Within this start, you know, the colder start, the rough bullpen stretch, and now this team turning it around. What have you been able to learn about first year manager Joe Espada? Obviously, big shoes to fill with the legend Dusty Baker moving on from that role. How has he handled the kind of ups and downs of this his first year as a manager?
I think the biggest thing Joe Espada has done or tried to do is just kind of keep calm and keep a steady hand. He kept saying early in the year, you know, I believe in this team. I believe we're going to turn things around. And I mean, you hear managers say things like that all the time, but sometimes you can tell they're just saying it. They're not so sure they believe it. But I think Joe legitimately believed that. And I think, you know, the players can tell the difference when a manager really believes in them and when he doesn't. And I think, you know, he gave guys a chance to turn things around. Certainly hasn't been afraid to make moves or to shake things up when, you know, necessary. Alex Bregman, when he was struggling, got dropped down in the order, for instance. You know, Jose Abreu, before he got released because of his struggles, he was batting eighth. So, you know, I mean, he wasn't afraid to do things like that and try and move things around to try and shake things up. But I think he didn't want to shake things up too much because I think when you do that, that's when panic can set in. But I think Joe legitimately believed that, you know, that the pieces were in place to turn things around, just needed to get a little more out of a few guys. And I think that's happened.
You mentioned a little earlier, Spencer Arrighetti. Arrigetti, rather, one of the guys who's had to fill in here because there have been so many injuries to the starting rotation. He's coming off of probably his best start in that Rockies game where he fanned 10 over seven innings, but he's been really, really up and down. I know some of this is probably just he's 24 and show me the 24-year-old starters that don't have a little bit of up and down. But what have you been able to make of, you know, where Arrigetti's at heading into this start tonight?
Well, I think he's made a few adjustments of late that have really helped him. The biggest thing, and this is something Hunter Brown has also done, is he's been able to throw a two-seam fastball into right-handers. Hunter Brown hadn't thrown that pitch since he was in college. Started throwing it at the end of May, and that's made the difference because it gave him something he could throw into righties, and it opened up the outside corner for him. Spencer Arrigetti has done something similar his last couple of starts, throwing that two-seamer into right-handed hitters because otherwise, you know, it's a lot of four-seamers at the top of the zone or just above the zone, and he's also been able to land his breaking balls for strikes near the bottom of the zone. So he now can attack horizontally and vertically, whereas before I don't think he really had the ability to do that, or at least wasn't doing that, and as a result was having some long at bats, some long innings, had a lot of trouble getting out of trouble. So I think definitely the two seamer being able to throw that into right handers has made a big difference for him.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see how he does tonight, because he has had some success against good lineups and some struggles against bad lineups, and the Blue Jays are kind of both depending on the day and who shows up. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. We'll see Ronel Blanco a little later in this series. And Robert, I was curious. I know you've been the voice of the Astros now for over 10 years, and you have called, you know, I still remember your Jose Altuve home run call to punch their ticket to the World Series. Where does getting to call the Ronel Blanco no-hitter rank for you in terms of games or moments that you've gotten to do?
I mean, you know, the coolest thing about what I do for a living is the fact that when you show up at the ballpark, you never know what you're going to see. I mean, you can look at the pitching matchup. You can look at both teams' lineups. You can look at how both teams have done and maybe have an idea of how the game will go, but you don't really know. And that was the beauty of Ronel Blanco's no-hitter. I mean, this was a guy who was the last man to make the rotation. He didn't find out until a week before that start that he was going to be in the rotation. And then his wife gave birth to their second child, like, right after that. It was like all this stuff happening for Ronel Blanco, a guy who wasn't even considered a starting pitcher a little more than a year and a half ago, was considered a reliever. And he had never thrown more than six innings in a start. He had never thrown more than 99 pitches in a game. There was absolutely no reason for anyone to think that Ronel Blanco was going to go out and do what he did. It's different if you're talking about, you know, a Justin Verlander in his prime or somebody like that. But yeah, you had no idea what was going to happen or that you were going to see that on that day. You know, and he added the changeup in spring training, made that a lot better, and that gave him another weapon. But yeah, there was no reason to believe that you'd see that. And then, you know, obviously as the outs keep going and the innings keep progressing, you're like, wait a second, we might have something here. And then I still remember that ninth inning. You could tell the inning started. Blanco was overthrowing a little bit. Yiner Diaz went out and settled him down, and he was able to complete the no-hitter. But yeah, that's one of the coolest things I've seen for sure, especially since, you know, you're not talking about an ace in his prime where every time out you're thinking, hey, he might throw a no-hitter. There was absolutely zero reason to think that we were going to see that night.
Yeah, so especially so early in the season. Yeah, it turns out that was a bad harbinger for this Blue Jays team and what their offense would look like. Robert, I did want to ask you a Jays question. I know because you've been there throughout George Springer's entire career, I'm sure you're aware he's had a bit of a tough season, turned it around a little bit of late. What have you made of where George Springer's at? Obviously a guy whose game you got to know pretty well over the years.
Well, one thing that didn't surprise me is when I talked to some Blue Jays people before the game yesterday, they said when Springer was even at his worst, he was still playing really well in right field, and the energy never wavered. And that didn't surprise me at all because that's the George Springer that I got to know in his time in Houston. Like, going to give 100% what a guy who provides so much energy, which is why he was such a good fit in the leadoff spot for so long for both the Astros and for the Blue Jays. Just needed to try and figure some things out. I think George Springer is just too talented to struggle for much longer than he did. And you can talk about age and all those things, but I think Springer will continue to be a productive player, and I'm not surprised that he's red hot right now.
Yeah, it's been fun to see, and the Jays really need it. Robert, before I let you go here, I wanted to pivot just outside of baseball for a second. I know you're a huge Knicks guy. The Knicks have had a pretty loud offseason early on here, trading a big pick package for Mikal Bridges, re-signing OG Anunoby to a big deal. How you feeling Knicks-wise?
You know, it's funny. When you think about the way the Knicks season ended, losing to a Pacers team that they were better than, but everybody on the Knicks was hurt. In the Eastern Conference semifinals, it was incredibly disappointing. However, and I've talked about this with other friends of mine who are Knicks fans, it's the most optimistic I've been going into a Knicks offseason in probably 25 years. They had some questions. I don't like Isaiah Hartenstein leaving in free agency, although I certainly understand it and I get it. I would have liked for the Knicks to give up fewer picks to get Mikal Bridges, but I think he'll be a nice piece. This is a Knicks team that's going to be very good. Are they going to be good enough to win the East? I don't know about that, especially, the Celtics are really good. But there's excitement about Knicks basketball in New York again, and it's been a while since that's been the case. So I'm pretty pumped about what we're going to see the rest of free agency and next season for the Knicks.
Yeah, well, it's exciting. It's a bit of a downtime for the Raptors right now as they kind of rebuild. So, yeah, having the Knicks, the Celtics, and now the 76ers with Paul George, too, all in the same division. We're going to get to see a lot of good basketball here, at least. Hopefully get to see some good basketball later tonight down at Rogers Center. Robert, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. Enjoy the rest of your time in Toronto.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Robert Ford, radio voice of the Houston Astros. Since 2013, yeah, and I'm one of the all-time good calls on a Jose Altuve home run. It's gone to punch their ticket to the World Series. A lot of fun to get to talk to Robert. Couple small updates for you. They put out the rosters for the Futures game, which is the Major League Baseball's prospect game that takes place around All-Star Weekend. And the Blue Jays will have a representative, as of course they do, Fernando Perez. Will be the representative for the Blue Jays. And he's an interesting name that we've touched on a little bit when we've done our prospect segments. He is just turned 20 at the start of the season, so pretty young for a starting pitcher prospect, certainly. He is already at A-ball in Dunedin, so that is even that alone is an encouraging step after splitting the last 2 years between the Dominican League and the Complex League. He's thrown 70 innings already this year, too, has a 360 ERA down at Dunedin, about 10 Ks per nine and 2.5 walks per nine. So a good job limiting the walks, some real swing and miss stuff there, keeps the ball on the ground fairly well. And the reports that we've heard about him, both on the show and off the show, are that for a 20-year-old, a pretty advanced feel and understanding of how to pitch. So even if, the 10 strikeouts per nine are very good, but a lot of times, when we're talking about pitching prospects, we're looking at 33% strikeout rate, 12 Ks per nine, whatever. In the case of Perez, it seems like there's a lot of pitchability there and a lot of appreciation within the organization for, his feel for pitching, his feel for the game at such an early age for a starter to be starting regularly at A-ball. I wonder, given his success at that level, if we even see them give him what would be a pretty aggressive push to High A Vancouver later in the year, even just for a taste of it ahead of next year. That Vancouver Canadiens team, red hot. They're the Houston Astros of the Northwest League. They had won 9 in a row until yesterday when that streak ended. But yeah, always interesting to see how the team will handle these promotion decisions with a guy who, I wouldn't say there's nothing left for him to learn. There's a lot for a 20-year-old to learn at any level, but he looks pretty good at Dunedin. Do you give him a taste of Vancouver at some point? It's also worth noting that because Perez was such a young signing, this is 2 years down the line, but he will eventually, quicker than some of the draft prospects, get on that Rule 5 eligibility protection radar 2026 for him. So, within the next 2 years, you probably want to be at least a little aggressive, getting him up to, you know, double A, triple A. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Joe Siddall. See what he thought of that game last night and a couple of key moments there at the dish. We'll also talk to Chandler Rome of The Athletic as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose a tough one, 3-1, down at Rogers Center yesterday. A story that barely familiar for the season, and even back to last year, not able to come through in their big opportunities. 0 for 6 with runners in scoring position, 8 men left on base. Let's see what Joe Siddall thought of it. He was on Blue Jay Central last night. Just a whole desk of guys looking good in Canadian-themed suits. Joe Siddall, Caleb Joseph, and Jamie Campbell. Joe joins us now. How we doing, Joe?
Good morning, Blake. Happy Canada Day. Day after, and it was a great day. The celebrations are so phenomenal at the ballpark. The Blue Jays do a great job with it, and I think that pregame stuff turned out to be the best part of the day again, unfortunately.
Got to ask you, look, we talk a lot about catcher defense, and you know this stuff better than I do. How did Buck look behind the plate, catching that first pitch from Ashley Stevenson?
I think the funniest comment of the day was that he didn't go down to one knee. I think he mentioned it on the broadcast. I mean, Buck is legendary, isn't he? He is so funny. He's just got the greatest comments, the greatest one-liners. But, pretty special for him and Ashley. That was very cool, a very nice touch.
Yeah, Ashley, of course, who went into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame a couple weeks back. Buck was honored at that weekend as well. Got to talk to Ashley on the show. Joe, on the actual baseball side, in terms of what happened once first pitch went out there, some missed opportunities for the Blue Jays. Again, I do want to get into some of the specifics of that eighth inning with you, but starting at a higher level, Hunter Brown, they're able to get the pitch count up on him in the first. They're able to get him in some trouble in the second, and then he just settles right down and mows through him from there. What did you like about Brown's performance against the Jays? And you know, on the other side of that, what didn't you like about the Jays just kind of not being able to take advantage of getting his back against the wall early?
Well, I love how Hunter Brown pitched and used his fastball. I just was astonished at how much he used it. And the sinker, we know, is a newer pitch for him. About a month into the season, he came up with this thing just to give him something inside the right-handers. And it was electric. His fastball was really good. It was just, I think, on the Blue Jays side, you've got to figure it out at some point. I mean, you can't tip your hat every day, right? It was Garrett Cole the day before, Hunter Brown this day. I mean, sooner or later, you have to beat good pitchers that are on, however you want to word it. Otherwise, you're going to be in this position. And he cruised. He was, I thought he was excellent. I thought the way he used that sinker, I had read about it and heard about it before the game, and I knew he was on a pretty good roll. But when you see it, you can see how it plays now and how it really kept those righties on. But it was amazing, Blake. I don't know if we've seen a guy throw this many fastballs. I mean, he's close to 80% fastballs with his usage throughout the game, and he used the four seamer as well. He elevated against lefties, and you could see that against a Horwitz, against a Varsho. I mean, he was elevating the four seamer, mixing the cutter in up there, and he wasn't really giving in. I think Horwitz had a pretty good at bat. He did double, but I think he had a good at bat earlier where he saw 11 pitches the first at bat. Great AB, but I give credit, all the credit in the world to Spencer in that AB, but I felt the entire AB. He's not getting this guy. Like, he's just the way he continued to pepper up there in the zone. It was a great job of pitching, attacking what was clearly the Astros think is a weakness. And Horwitz is going to have to continue. It was great AB, but he's going to have to continue. And I'm sure he will slowly keep realizing what teams are doing to him now.
Yeah. And look, if you're the Astros, you got to be really encouraged, not only by Brown's results over the last little bit, but that Horwitz at bat, he just keeps challenging them in that upper part of the zone and just kind of throws that four seamer a bunch, throws them some knuckle curves, some cutters, all kind of attacking around the zone, not getting too cute and not nibbling too much. Really nice Hunter Brown performance, and Jays kicking themselves for not taking advantage of getting the bases loaded with one out in the second. They basically had nothing after that, Joe, until the eighth inning. Brian Abreu gets into some trouble there. And at this point, the Jays are only down 1-0. So you need to get one across. There are a couple things I wanted to ask you about in this inning. And I want to start with Bo Bichette's strikeout. So with one on, and I believe there was nobody out yet in that inning. So Barger had just taken a walk, and Bo Bichette gets a called strike on a slider in the zone, then fouls the slider off in the zone, and then 0-2 swings at a really bad, like, ball-to-ball slider that's low and away. Was that, you know, kind of indicative of where Bo's at since coming back off the IL here, chasing a slider like that that never really presented in the zone much?
It's almost like feels like this has been Bo's year. You know, he buckled on the first pitch. That's okay. You give it to him. It's 0-1, but I thought the way he swung at the 0-1, it was a hanging slider right out over the plate. And I think Bo has gone back and forth and back and forth all year on what he's going to do early in the count. And is he going to try to catch something up front and do damage? Or is he going back to his old approach where I got to let the ball travel. That way I can hit the off speed and the breakers and I can still foul off fastball, stay alive. Like, it just seems like there is this constant approach issue going on in his head, and I'll maybe like a confusion, not sure what to do, because the way he missed the 0-1 hanging slider, to me, he was really pulling off, like he kind of pulled off the baseball, and that's why he didn't get it. If he's on that, if he has good direction with that swing and stays on it, catches it out front, that's where he does damage. And that's the old Bo that we used to see so well early in the count, where he would try to do that stuff and get on you. But he really pulled off of that pitch. And once he pulled off that pitch, I was like, okay, so I think the mental approach is right. Like, he's trying to catch that thing up front and do damage, but the physical approach wasn't, the way he was pulling off. So there is so much going on in that swing, but I also think there's so much going on between the years with his approach. And the season, it really kind of summed up the season. And then 0-2, yeah, two-strike approach and terrible pitch and chases. So it turns out just to be an awful at-bat, but I kind of summed up the season, right, that we've seen with Bo after seeing some pretty darn good seasons from him. And that's what's so astonishing, I think, to all of us.
Yeah, and there was, you know, in that first inning, he grounded out, and it was 97, that sinker that comes back in, but Hunter Brown kind of left it in a meaty part of the plate, and Bo just grounded it to short. So even when you get one there, mentioned the slider in that at-bat.
Right?
Pardon me?
Deep again, though, right?
Yeah.
Like 97, yes, and it's the first at-bat of the game, and we get all that, but 1-1. Like, I think we like Bo 1-1 thinking, hey, I'm going to catch something out front here, right? And
Again,
it's 97. It's the first time you've seen him. Like, I get all that, but we've seen it a lot this year.
Yeah, well, we certainly have. So I guess, you know, there's so much going on that maybe there's not a good answer for this one, Joe. But if Bo were to start turning this thing around, what kind of thing are you looking for first here? Is it an approach thing? Is it how he's getting to, you know, a slider like that that does hang? Like what would be the first thing that turns a light on for you of, oh, maybe Bo's got something clicking here?
Yeah, like maybe that 0-1 hanging slider that I'm referring to that he pulled off of. He takes a much better swing, stays on it better, catches it out front, drives it into the left center gap. You know, early in the count, these early counts, 0-0, 0-1, 1-0, taking those shots, trying to do damage out front. And then, you know, I don't mind him going two-strike approach. And, when he was at his best, we saw him in that two-strike approach, and he'd shoot some balls the other way. And he would do it early in the count, too, but I think he's just conceding too much to his abilities to just be thinking oppo, 0-0 with a fastball. Like, he should be thinking do damage because he's capable of it. And I think he can be that 300-type hitter we've seen with the 2025 homers rather than trying to be what? I don't know. Not this. You know, not this. And that's why I just think there feels or seems like there's just a lot of confusion going on with what he wants to do and thus what he is doing.
Okay, so in that eighth inning, Bo strikes out there. That brings up Horwitz. So one runner, Barger on first, one out, and Horwitz, again, they're only down 1-0 at this point. Horwitz laces a double down the right field line. Trey Cabbage does a pretty good job getting to it. The Jays decide not to send Addison Barger. If you watch it back, he's about a step short of third base at the time Cabbage picks up the ball and turns to get ready to hit the cutoff man at first base. Were you surprised that Barger didn't get the wave in a situation like that?
I was surprised in live action because I swiveled on my chair and I was watching the field. And I thought he was getting the wave, but when he didn't get the wave and then watching it back, and of course, as analysts, we have that luxury that we can watch things back in slow motion. Third base coaches don't get that, remember? And I think the part of the lineup that you're in, first of all, But also when I watched it back probably a third or fourth time, as that first baseman's receiving the ball, remember, he's like 90 feet from home plate. That's a quick throw home. So I don't think it was going to be a good idea to send him, but bigger part of it is you've got Turner and a pretty hot Turner and Springer coming up. You like your chances to at least score one run, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And if anyone is, you know, if there's anyone on the roster you're going to trust to have a pro at bat and put the ball in the air and, you know, flip one for a sack fly or something like that, it's Turner. And then he gets hit, which you're thinking, oh, that's not bad. At least you got the bases loaded here. It turns out, though, you know, maybe you would have rather had the bat in Turner's hand there. Springer, you know, that wasn't the, you know, the best plate appearance he's had recently. Brian Abreu did a really good job staying low and away, and on the one that he lined out there, he kind of had to play defense. That was a slider right on the outside edge. What did you see from Springer in that plate appearance? And are you buying what we've seen the last little bit here from George?
Well, what I'm buying is he's been on the fastball a lot better, and that's really good news, and that's really good to see. But I think in that at bat, after starting with a couple of fastballs, he wasn't getting another one. And once it got to one, he got ahead. But then once it got to one and one, I thought the Astros did a great job just staying away with the breakers. We know George has struggled with the breaking pitches. And in that situation, the last thing you want to do is get beat with the fastball against a hitter that has clearly been showing he's hitting the fastball much better, and that has struggled with breaking pitches. But not only that, he put them both, as you just said, he located them both away there beautifully. So he got the swinging strike, and then it was a looping line. When he hit it, I thought he smoked it, but he didn't. It kind of got off the end of the bat. But again, that's because of the location of the pitch. So I credited the Astros' strategy by spinning the baseball against George right there, but also the execution of the pitches was perfect.
Yeah, so in terms of George's ability to hit that velocity a little bit better lately, you know, the Nestor Cortez double stands out. Even yesterday, he singled on a pretty solid cutter and then had a loud out on a sinker at 95. Have you seen, you know, a change mechanically in George? Like, is there something he's doing to be able to get to that higher velocity better?
Well, you'll notice his hands are different. It's his hands are kind of in front of his face a little bit more. So like a tighter concept. When I asked him about it, he just chuckled because sometimes players might try a subtle change and not, I think nobody's going to notice, but this wasn't so subtle because his hands used to be much higher and he was standing much taller, but his hands are a little bit different spot. And he just said, just trying to get to a position where I can make my body move more efficiently. When I took that as code for get to the fastball and, you know, we refer to his bottom half, and it's something he's trying, he's working at it, and it's shown good results. So far so good. But I think too, even with what I am seeing, it's looks similar to me to what he was doing before. And that's why I think if he is committing to get to these fastballs a little bit more with whatever he's doing mechanically, that's great to get to the fastballs. But then are we going to now see, and he's been out for a little while, give him credit, but now maybe we're going to see opposing teams, and tonight might be another good example, but do what Abreu did at that at bat and see maybe if you're committed to fastballs so much, you're going to be very susceptible to spin. So we'll see if he can handle that, because we see in this league, we see it with young players all the time, and we've seen it with David Schneider and, you know, Varsho and Horwitz, these guys, that the league adjusts, man, and you've got to be able to adjust back. So I'm anxious to keep watching this, but it's always good news that if you're going to do one thing, be on the fastball, because we all know you're going to get some.
Right, and, you know, we're going to see a kid tonight who's 24 in Spencer Arrighetti, and he's trying to, you know, mix in more of the sinker like Hunter Brown has done too. But this kid's been all over the place in his major league rookie season here. So, you know, this should be one that maybe it favors the veterans a little bit, since this kid's still trying to figure it out. That inning ended that eighth with a ground out from Varsho. Another good pitch, maybe something he could have laid off 2-1. Not as worried necessarily with that one, Joe, but generally over the last 5 weeks, if we go back to May 26th, Varsho's only hit one home run and he's got a 555 OPS, obviously doing a lot of good work defensively still. Any concern for you with this kind of extended cold stretch here from a guy who we know is a pretty streaky hitter generally?
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of concerns, Blake. I mean, I felt this last year, even when Dalton was really good at times, and it's hard to talk about guys like that when they're going through hot streaks, but I think when guys, it's kind of a one-dimensional swing. I think Dalton's got kind of a loop where it comes out and around the ball, and that's why he's still centric, right? Everything's coming around into the pull side. And if you look at that ground ball, yes, he hit it hard, unfortunately, right at the second baseman. But to me, it's still not a good swing path. But that is his swing path. That, I don't see a whole lot of change in that. And that's why you continue to see when teams execute that good fastball at the top of the zone or come in, that's when he goes through stretches. And I think what happens is you go through stretches when you're, I don't know if one-dimensional is the right way, but you know what I mean? But I feel like he's got the loop. The hands kind of go back and around and then come in and out of the zone. And it's when you run into it, and I call it the old squirrel nut, right? Every squirrel finds a nut. If the timing is right, you can run into it and hit it into the seats or hit it into the gap or down the line. And we've seen that. Sometimes it's an off-speed pitch, but if it's a changeup that's got anything going away, he's going to struggle. But if you leave that change up middle down, middle in down, that's right into the barrel, right? So I don't see a whole lot of adjustability in that swing. It's kind of like it is what it is. And when pitchers kind of make mistakes to his barrel, he'll do some damage. But that's not conducive to any kind of consistent approach at the plate. Now, he does so many other things defensively, base running, it was on and on, that if he could just do that and run into 25 to 30 homers, he's a very valuable player, right? But I just wonder, like, I wonder when that trade was made, that if the Blue Jays, and they got a good player, let's not get this wrong, but I think maybe when they make that trade, they're probably thinking they're getting a guy that's more of a 750 OPS guy that's going to hit 25 to 30. But remember when he did that in Arizona, he was, it might have been his first full year in the big leagues, maybe. So the league maybe hadn't totally known him yet. And now they're pitching him accordingly. Now pitchers miss their spots, right? And that's when they miss their spots, that's when you do damage. So I think he's just that kind of hitter. And unfortunately, the inconsistencies of that kind of hitter, you're going to go through stretches like this.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, that OPS on the season now down to 679. And we're only a couple weeks removed from it looking like maybe he had figured some things out and was headed for a career year. But instead, very similar to last year now when you look at the numbers across the board. Joe, before I let you go, let's end on a positive here. Since they're you know, obviously
are
coming.
Are there any?
I mean, I was going to ask you about Yariel Rodriguez last night. It's certainly something to build on. One earned over 6 2/3, a little more efficient getting through innings. And then, the one mistake to Pena that was a really poorly hung curveball there. But otherwise, really, really attacking. What did you like from Yariel? What can we build on from that one?
Yeah, well, you nailed it. It was a mistake curveball, but pitchers make mistakes during great outings, and he was fantastic yesterday. Really encouraged, especially with his location. It was like he was pounding the edges of the zone. It was remarkable to see. I thought that he had the good fastball, which was great to see because, you know, I heard mostly when Yariel was signed and coming to the Blue Jays, I heard about how he spun the baseball. So a lot of breakers, a lot of sliders, curveballs, really a good breaking ball pitcher. And I'm thinking, that's a pretty good fastball we were seeing yesterday. And he broke it out early and he was using it. But then even in the first inning, that splitter that he threw to Yordan Alvarez to get the little bounce out back to the mound. So he's got the secondary weapons, but man, did that fastball ever play yesterday. And more importantly than anything, yeah, he was locating the baseball great. Great signs all around. I think he took a little page out of the, sometimes I call it the Berrios-Bassett book, where they really pound the lefties away. It's like sinkers and four seamers away, kind of up and away, and he mixes in the curveball and the splitter. And then the righties, same thing. He was kind of using the four seamer up because, again, it was such a good fastball. So that's going to be important, right? Because I think anytime platoon wise, the lefties are probably going to give you more trouble, even though that hasn't been the case so far. I think it's still small sample size material for Rodriguez, but really good fastball. And I like the way he used it as much as he did because it was good and used the secondary pitches to play off that. He was excellent. And boy, the Blue Jays never need this. I mean, we don't want to fast forward too fast, Blake, but this year, but also moving forward, they need a starting pitcher, right? Like that homegrown type guy.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And they're going to need him in this fist fight. I thought he also saved the bullpen yesterday when I don't know what the plan was. Like Bowden Francis, I don't think was available yesterday. I don't know what the plan was if Yariel had another like four inning outing, Joe.
Have you ever heard of a pitcher? We were doing the game in Boston during that rain delay. He pitched one inning and Dan and I are looking out in the bullpen. He's pitching in the rain, like literally the rain. It was raining pretty heavily at times. So then he sat down and then he got up again. So he kind of simulated basically like three innings of work, which was great on the Blue Jays to do that because with all these games in a row, there are no days off, so you're not going to alter your rotation. So basically that was his start, and I was looking forward to seeing how he would rebound from that, and maybe they're on to something because he was excellent.
Yeah, and look, he's at 45 innings for the season now between AAA and the Jays, and I don't know how much the injury stuff changes there, but we had heard about 100 innings for the season, so who knows? Maybe if he looks this good, they let him extend a little bit, and hey, if you only need 83 pitches to get into the seventh, maybe you could pitch a few more innings there as well. Joe, thank you so much for taking the time out, man.
All right, Blake, always good. Take care.
Joe Siddall of Sportsnet, of course, on a lot of the calls with Dan Shulman on Blue Jay Central with Jamie Campbell and Caleb Joseph for this series. Pretty much no one who's better to talk about the science of hitting with than Joe Siddall. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue to set up the rest of the series and tonight's game. It is Spencer Arrighetti and Jose Berríos. We'll talk to Chandler Rome, who covers the Astros for The Athletic, one of the best beat writers out there. We'll look a little deeper on Spencer Arrighetti. We'll see, we'll check in on Ronel Blanco, who we're going to see a little later in this series as well. It is Jose Berríos, Spencer Arrighetti today. Yusei Kikuchi against Ronel Blanco tomorrow. And then that Thursday, 1 p.m. getaway day, Chris Bassitt against Framber Valdez. And Joe mentioned it. This is a stretch of 17 game days in a row. So the Jays get a breather after the Seattle series, where they go to on Friday for three on the road, but then it's six more on the West Coast after one day off there. So they're going to need Yariel. They're going to need these bullpen arms to come through. Small bit of positive news at AAA yesterday in that Ryan Burzbach off the IL. He didn't pitch particularly well, but he seems to have avoided a scare there with a forearm issue. And Eric Swanson had his best outing as a Buffalo Bison yesterday. He got five outs without allowing a run. The bar is a little low there. He's still got a double-digit ERA, but something to build on there, perhaps, that he got through a multi-inning outing without any, scary contact there or anything like that. So that'll be something we keep an eye on, because there is going to be bullpen churn in the coming weeks. Jimmy Garcia is going to pitch off a mound again yesterday or tomorrow, rather, and see how that goes. But otherwise, there are no reinforcements coming. Jordan Romano's got that follow-up with Dr. Keith Meister today, the Keith Meister. And then, yeah, you're looking to AAA. You've got six pitchers down there who are on the 40-man, one of them in Hagen Danner, who's hurt. And then you've got a couple interesting prospects who aren't on the 40-man. But we're going to see some churn. We're going to see some churn in July, because that's how bullpen works. And, maybe at some point you'll want to get a different look than Jose Quas or something like that, just to mix it up. But also, this bullpen has been pretty taxed, because the starters outside of Chris Bassitt haven't been going quite as long. And, 17 game days in a row. So very good that Yariel Rodriguez saved the bullpen. And now you head into 2 days where it's, Jose Berríos, 3 days rather, Jose Berríos, Yusei Kikuchi, Chris Bassitt. You've got your kind of long guys in Berríos and Bassitt, two of the next 3 days. Maybe you can get to the Seattle series, the next Gausman, Yariel part of the rotation, feeling okay. And yes, it feels weird that we're talking about Gausman as the backside of the rotation, where maybe you need a little extra length out of the bullpen, but that is where things are right now. Let's take a break. Let's talk Houston Astros with Chandler Rome as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, little Kyle Tucker walk-up music, even though he is on the IL. There's also been some Houston Astros warm-up music drama of late. I don't know if there's actual drama, but Spencer Arrighetti took Hunter Brown's warm-up music. I'm going to ask Chandler Rome about it, that when we talk to him in a little bit here. We will see Spencer Arrighetti on the hill tonight. Little about him. I've mentioned it yesterday and today, and this is, as someone who plays a lot of fantasy baseball, you get to know these kind of fringy guys who have outlier performances sometimes, because you're maybe going to stream them here and there. Maybe they're a breakout candidate. And Arrighetti has had some, like, hey, I'm going to strike out 10 guys over 7 shutout innings. And then also some really good performances against good teams, bad performances against poor teams. He's been a tough guy to stream. And you dig in, and the underlying profile is just as all over the place. So he's got a 5.68 ERA. The underlying numbers show a 4.14 expected ERA. So that's the Statcast metric that looks at strikeouts and walks and the quality of contact and things like that. Weirdly, because of the offensive environment we're in, a 4.14 expected ERA is like not that great. It's not like it's amazing. But he strikes out a lot of guys, 75 strikeouts over 65 innings, gets a good amount of swing and miss. And that, you know, 75 strikeouts in 65 innings is a good K rate, even in the modern environment. Weirdly, he doesn't get a lot of chase, though. Guys don't swing outside of the zone. It's just they have trouble squaring up what is in the zone. So because he works out of the zone a lot and guys don't swing it a ton, he'll walk a few too many guys. He can also be mistake prone. Giancarlo Stanton hit a ball against him 119.9 miles an hour earlier this year. That is the fourth hardest hit ball in all of baseball this season, and it is the quickest I've ever seen a home run leave a ballpark. So there are occasional mistakes like that. We'll get to know Spencer Arrighetti a little bit more. First, let's talk to Chandler Rome of The Athletic. He covers the Astros, one of the best beat writers out there. And Chandler, welcome to Toronto, where you not only got a 2 hour and 16 minute game on Canada Day. How'd you like the poutine bar, man?
I could live here just to eat the poutine. And then I'm gonna do a plug on this show. I hope it's okay.
Absolutely.
I went to the Loose Moose Saloon after, got some deluxe truffle poutine at about 9:30. Great way to end my first Canada Day experience.
Yeah, and look, there's no Blue Jay fan experience quite like stumbling out of a game and ending up at the Loose Moose for something to eat. That is that's a classic. So glad you got to enjoy that. Glad you enjoyed the Canada Day festivities. And man, you're getting to cover a pretty good team right now. 10 of 11 for the Astros here. I know you wrote about last week when they kind of started to turn it on. There was no sense of relief with this team because obviously they still have work to do. But what is the vibe around this team right now that things are clicking and hey, they're firmly back, not just in the wild card, but in the AL West race here?
You can tell it's definitely looser. Definitely a lot more carefree, a little more relaxed. I don't think they're taking their foot off the gas. I don't think that they're, letting their guard down by any means, because, I mean, when you start 7-19, pretty much every game from here on out is going to be in urgency mode unless they can run off a string of, 20 out of 25 and really distance themselves from 500. But this is a team that's still not on all cylinders. Kyle Tucker hasn't played in almost a month. Justin Verlander's on the IL. They've got four other starters missing, two for the remainder of the season and two more that aren't coming back until the All-Star break. So this is still kind of a wounded team, but they've got guys stepping up all over the place. Mauricio Dubon has really, really injected some life into this lineup. You look at, Joey Loperfido, a guy that came up from AAA, really stood out in spring training this year, came up from AAA, and the numbers aren't going to wow you. But I do think, this team for a long time has missed athleticism and speed. And this is a team that's getting a little bit older. Having some youth, having some speed, some energy in their lineup has really, really helped them, I think. And then their big guys are playing well too. Yordan Alvarez obviously homered yesterday. Alex Bregman has turned around what was an awful start to his season. And then you look at what Ronel Blanco and Hunter Brown have done to kind of stabilize the rotation. And you see a path where this thing is, where they can get some distance to 500 and maybe be back where they think they belong.
You mentioned Hunter Brown there. Obviously, he dominates the Jays yesterday. A little trouble early with the pitch count in the first inning and then a bases loaded one out situation in the second. But he gets out of those jams, cruises. We're now looking at an 11 start stretch where he's been pretty unbelievable and only one earned run over his last 31 innings. You wrote a great piece for The Athletic last night about this, about, his chats with Ryan Pressly to kind of keep the confidence and help him work through it. What has gone into this Hunter Brown turnaround?
I mean, first of all, let's remember where this guy was in April. His third start of the season against the Royals, he allowed 11 hits and 9 earned runs in 2/3 of an inning. It is not hyperbole to say that is the worst start in Major League Baseball history. Like, no starting pitcher has ever given up 11 hits in less than an inning in Major League history. So not hyperbolic to say he went from making the worst start in Major League history to maybe being the best pitcher in baseball right now. It's been an unbelievable turnaround. And this is a guy that they've always known had the stuff. He was a top pitching prospect a couple of years ago, cracked a ton of top 100 lists. But it's with him, it's been about figuring out how his stuff plays at the big league level. He added a sinker on May 5th, just out of nowhere. Alex Bregman had kind of begged him to throw it. So he started throwing it against the Mariners. And I even wrote in the story this morning, you know, it's not as if the sinker is a good pitch. It does not grade out metrically well, but just the fact that he can come inside against right-handed hitters, because everything he throws, his four-seam, his cutter, his changeup, his slider, it all tails away from right-handed hitters. His four-seam has some perceived cut that cuts away. He needed something to keep these guys honest on the inner half, because coaches and teammates kind of saw right-handed hitters just selling out, leaning over the plate and getting ready to hit whatever he threw there. Just the fact that he's been able to show that sinker on the inner half and get some weak contact has made everything else play so well. And I think the confidence has just grown from there. You know, Ryan Pressly is a guy that's helped him a lot. He wrote yesterday that they had a long conversation on the plane ride back from Kansas City when I don't think any of us thought Hunter Brown was long for this rotation. I mean, they were in desperation mode. They still had some help. They still had some guys that they could have cycled in there. You know, his rotation spot was very much in peril. And now you kind of wonder where they'd be without him. I assume he's going to be American League Pitcher of the Month here in about the next hour when they announce that award. But even if he's not, he's been incredible. And he and Ronel Blanco really are the two reasons why the Astros have remained afloat throughout this kind of topsy-turvy beginning of the year.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff there. And I mean, you see it yesterday. Like, obviously, this is not something we can, like, directly quantify. Like, hey, how does the sinker help the slider and the changeup and the knuckle curve play up? But, like, all those pitches have way higher chase rates since he introduced the sinker. So, obviously, there's something about how guys are picking it up. And yesterday, I mean, we just played a clip of George Springer doing the, like, tip with the bat off the helmet of just like, you got me, man. I had no idea. I guess probably the way those things tunnel and things like that. How close was it? Like, obviously the Astros have had so many injuries that even if Hunter Brown had just gotten back to being okay, they probably would have had to ride with him, similar to what they're doing with Spencer Arrighetti right now. But how close was he to like, hey, you got to figure this out in the minors, even with injuries, we can't let you keep going like this.
Oh, they moved him to the bullpen. He was moved to the bullpen in the beginning of May. He made one appearance out of the bullpen in Detroit. His hometown came in and actually struck out 10 guys in five innings. I think everyone sort of thought that was a mirage, just given that the Tigers are just a listless lineup and you didn't want to make too much of it. And he hadn't started throwing the sinker at that point. But he did move to the bullpen. They only moved him because they had a ton of off days and they needed to make their rotation work. And so it was always going to be brief, but they moved him once. And from what I was told, and I quoted the pitching coach, Josh Miller, in the story this morning, you know, he didn't know that they'd have enough time to get him to bounce back before they would have had to make a decision. And I think he was maybe on, you know, maybe one more start. And if that start wouldn't have gone well, he may have ended up in Sugarland in AAA to work some stuff out. It's been an incredible turnaround for him, and you can just tell he's pitching with so much more confidence. His body language looks good. You know, he's running the fastball up to 98, 99 when he was like 95, 96 before. He's much freer. You can tell he's much more on attack than I think he ever was at the beginning of this year. And it's, you know, again, it's hard to quantify confidence or measure that, but he's pitching with a ton of it.
Okay. So that's great. It's a funny phrase. You're getting sent to Sugarland. Like, to me, that sounds like a nice thing. Just like, here's a like dessert buffet for you. Instead, obviously, not great if you are an Astros pitcher. So how much of it? Look, Hunter Brown's stuff is incredible. The sinker is really good. I would imagine there's a little bit of, hey, Spencer Arrighetti, can you figure this out too? Because they need him right now. Obviously a different style of pitcher, but also someone who's, you know, dabbled with, you know, throwing, I guess in his case, a cutter instead of a sinker as a secondary fastball there. Also, if I'm remembering your tweets right, Spencer Arrighetti took Hunter Brown's warm-up music. Am I remembering this correctly?
Well, so for the first month of his big league career, Spencer Arrighetti's warm-up music was Bulls on Parade by Rage Against. Last start, he switched to Ted Nugent's Stranglehold. Hunter Brown, who is a Detroit native and I think has the rights to do whatever he wants with Ted Nugent, just given that he is a Detroit native. Hunter Brown, he switched. I don't know if this is publicly out there, but this is not like huge breaking news, but he switched because they were on the road somewhere, and a reliever for another team, I can't remember who, had Stranglehold as his entrance music. And Hunter Brown was like, no. Like, I want to have the only, I want to be unique in what I use. So he changed to Just What the Doctor Ordered by Ted Nugent so he can keep the Detroit roots going. And I guess Spencer Arrighetti needed to change something because he wasn't pitching well before he pitched against the Rockies a couple of days ago. And again, with the caveat that it's the Rockies, they are pretty awful. Had his best start as a big leaguer, struck out 10 guys. He's still the only starting pitcher this year to strike out 10 guys in a game. And I think the key was he just threw strikes. He wasn't nibbling. He wasn't, you know, afraid around the edges. He threw strikes. He attacked the strikes. And I think he threw 20 of 24 first pitch strikes. Again, he's kind of a different case than Hunter Brown. I think in an ideal world, if everything had gone to plan and their entire rotation wouldn't have fallen apart to injury, I think Spencer Arrighetti would still be in AAA right now. They thought he would debut this year. They expected him to debut this year, but I think they wanted him to get a lot more seasoning in AAA. He's up here out of sheer necessity. And I think he's acquitted himself very well. He's had a couple of clunkers. He's had a couple of not great starts that you would expect with a young guy, but the potential is there. You can see it. I think, you know, what scouts told me when he came up, what they worried about was that he didn't have a consistent way to miss bats. He didn't have one pitch to go to when he needed to get a strikeout, when he needed to get a whiff. And I don't really think one is like he's found one since he's been up here. His fastballs play okay. His cutter is probably the pitch he relies on the most, just doing what he can with that. But he's still definitely a work in progress. One of the more cerebral, just analytically driven guys I've ever met. Certainly a pitcher well suited for this generation of up and coming talent. Can tell you exactly what his horizontal and vertical movement is on everything immediately after he finishes. Wants to talk to you about pitch shape, wants to talk to you about tunneling, sequencing, all that stuff. Very, very well versed in that stuff. But I do think with that, you do need to have some feel. You do need to have just some gut feeling out there and how you go about a game. And I think you kind of saw that last time out. You know, he just said, you know what, screw it. I'm throwing the ball in the strike zone, and if it gets hit, I've got defense behind me. I'm just going to try to limit the hard contact. And he did that. Maybe we'll see that against a Blue Jays team that, you know, this Blue Jays team, for as bad as they've been, you know, I'm sure you know, like, they don't swing and miss. They don't strike out. They put the ball in play, which I think is going to be a test for Spencer Arrighetti, somebody that doesn't have a bat missing pitch that does allow a good bit of contact. It'll be interesting to see if he can keep it maybe on the ground and weak tonight.
It'll be interesting to see. The Jays are a tough offense to figure out. Arrighetti, obviously a tough pitcher to figure out so far. By the way, Ryan O'Hearn of the Orioles and Adrian Hauser of the Mets are the two other guys that use Stranglehold, and you guys have seen them both recently. So a couple opportunities there.
It may have been, was Hauser with the Brewers last year?
Yeah.
It may have been when they went to Milwaukee. I think that's okay. Exactly when it was. Adrian Hauser came in to Stranglehold, and that's when Hunter Brown was like, oh, okay, like somebody else has this. I gotta change.
Yeah, there are a lot of songs out there, but you can't expect guys to know who everyone else's song is. And I appreciate you always covering when guys change their walk-up songs, because that's always fascinating for me too. I would be the most annoying hitter in base. Like, I would be like, I'm 0-3. Change my song for the fourth at bat. Like, we got to mix this up. We got to change it up. And you can tell Spencer Arrighetti, well, I guess you probably won't talk to him since it's start day, but the Rogers Center does put up the horizontal and vertical breaks. And we'll see sometimes, like, I think it was Glasnow early in the year, like looking over the shoulder at the readings on the Rogers Center board there. Okay. Elsewhere in this rotation, Chandler, what do things look like the next little bit for Justin Verlander here? Obviously, there are a number of holes in the rotation, McCullers, Urquidy, Javier, a bunch of guys, but Verlander kind of front of mind as both the biggest name and a guy who was struggling a little bit when we saw him last.
Yeah, it's been very odd. It's been very vague, but that's kind of how the Astros handle all of their injuries. So we don't want to sound too much alarm. It just sounds like it's a neck thing that he can't shake. I will say that with the caveat of they put Christian Javier on the IL originally with neck discomfort, just like they put Justin Verlander. And Christian Javier had Tommy John surgery 3 weeks ago. Okay. The Astros have been very insistent that this is not an elbow, arm, any sort of issue, but they haven't given much substantial specifics other than that. Justin Verlander talked to us once and has since deferred basically every question to the team. He's not on this road trip. He's eligible to come off the IL. Yesterday was the first day he was eligible to come off, and he has resumed playing catch, but just from 60 feet, like not with a ton of intensity. At this point, just looking at the calendar, I'd be surprised if he's back before the All-Star break, just because they're running out of days here. He's going to need a minor league rehab assignment. And if he's not off the mound within the next, 5 or 6 days, I think it probably wouldn't be feasible for him to come back before the All-Star break, which has a lot of both short-term and long-term ramifications for the Astros. He's on a contract that has a vesting player option if he throws 140 innings this year. He's only thrown 57 and two-thirds. It is getting harder and harder to envision him reaching 140 innings with every day he's not in this rotation. So for him, that makes him a free agent after this year. For the Astros, that does give a little bit of a hole in next year's rotation. But they seem pretty confident that he's going to be back at some point this year to help them. You could tell he wasn't right his last couple starts. With Verlander, it is so odd to see him not command the baseball, and he didn't command the ball well at all. His last two starts, I think against the Angels, he hit three guys with his fastball, which is very, very uncharacteristic of him. He was pretty adamant that everything was okay, but you can just tell something was a little bit off. And again, without knowing more of like what is it with his neck, I don't want to speak out of turn, but it just sounds like it's something that they needed to give some time for him to rest. And he is back to picking up a baseball, but I'd be surprised if you see him before the All-Star break.
That's a tough one then. And like, obviously, maybe he comes back after the All-Star break. The Astros could obviously play the trade route now that they're back in the playoff picture here. But you look and okay, well, Brown, Blanco, Valdez, and Arrighetti have basically been in the rotation the whole way, whether they like it or not. And then you have Verlander, Javier, JP France, who they kind of admitted that they rushed back. And even Jake Bloss came up and then immediately got hurt. In the short term here, is it probably just like another Sean Dubin-led bullpen day that the next time they have I think they have another one on Friday, a spot where there's not currently a starter penciled in?
I think they need to see how these three games go. If Blanco and Valdez, the last two games of this series, if they can get them deep into the game, just like they've been doing all year, then I think they could do a bullpen game. They still have a guy in AAA named Eric Lauer. He's made 115 big league starts in his career. He's in AAA on a minor league deal. Had an opt-out in his contract yesterday. Did not exercise it because he's still listed in every part of the organization. He is on the probables to pitch in Sugarland on Friday when they would need a fifth starter. They could call him up, but they have already bypassed him for three spot starts this year, which would suggest to me that they're not very confident in what he can give them. But he's down there. He's an option. I think if their bullpen is intact going into Minnesota and they haven't had to use Dubin and they haven't had to use a ton of their guys, they would probably just cobble it together as a bullpen game again. But it's unsustainable. They can't keep doing it like this. Jake Bloss, guy you mentioned, he would be eligible to come back on their next homestand. I think they'd want to just reinsert him into the rotation as a traditional starter, but this kind of encapsulates where their year has been pitching-wise. Jake Bloss has made 8 starts above A-ball, and they called him up. He bypassed AAA to debut against the Baltimore Orioles, of all teams. They brought him up straight from AA, and then he gets hurt. It's just been that kind of season for them. They have had so many pitching injuries that it is almost going to be a question this offseason. Do they need to reevaluate their pitching permit? Do they need to reevaluate their training staff, their medical staff, like how they're getting these guys back to play? Because look, every team deals with arm injuries. It's an epidemic across baseball, but the fact that this many have happened in such a short time frame with the Astros is certainly something they're going to have to look at, and they're going to have to figure out why this is happening and whether this is truly just part of baseball's epidemic or whether this is something that they need to really dig into a little further.
And maybe some sort of, you know, for some of these guys who've been around a little bit, maybe the cost of being in the playoffs every year too, right? Like guys are pitching a little longer, the offseason's a little shorter and things like that. Safe to say, Chandler, that they're three games back now. So, you know, they're probably back into at worst a hold and probably a buyer at the deadline. Safe to say if they were buyers at the deadline, the starting rotation is probably where they target.
I think that's their biggest need. And they don't need to go out and get Garrett Crochet. They don't need an ace. They need an Eric Fetty type. Like I'm thinking of the White Sox. Like they need that kind of guy. That guy that, you know what, he's going to get you into the sixth inning every time he pitches. It may not be dominant. He may give up a couple runs here and there, but they need a veteran that's got some wear and tear on his arm that they know is going to be durable and able to get them through this season. Because I think the other thing they're working with here, Ronel Blanco's never thrown more than 120 innings in any professional season. He's only been a starter for 2 years. Spencer Arrighetti only never thrown more than 125 innings in any professional season. Like these two guys are going to blow past their innings workloads probably by the end of July, early August. And you wonder how that's going to affect their effectiveness. And they're going to get Lance McCullers and Luis Garcia back after the All-Star break. But if you're counting on guys just fresh off of major elbow surgery to give you effective outings and to give you deep outings, that's misguided. Like, yes, they will be bodies. They will represent depth. And they will be able to start games and help. But I think it's misguided to think that those guys are going to come in and just start taking down seven innings to start with one run allowed. Like that's usually not how this works. So they need an established starter. They need to go get some depth to augment this rotation. And then the other area you look at that I think could pique some Blue Jays' interest, they need a first baseman. The Jose Abreu situation was a complete disaster. They cut ties with him last month. Mauricio Dubon and John Singleton are kind of in a platoon timeshare there. Mauricio Dubon has not played first base since high school. John Singleton, certainly a great career arc, great story for him that he was able to author this comeback, but I don't think he's the long-term answer. Loperfido is a guy that has played some first base in the minor leagues, but they are still very hesitant to expose him there at the major league level. They need a first baseman, and they don't just need a first baseman for this stretch run. They need a first baseman for the long term because they don't have anyone in their system that can play first base either. So I don't know if that leads – I don't know where that leads them. I think their bigger need is starting pitching. I mean, they have four healthy starters on their 40-man roster right now. Like, that's unacceptable. Like, they need – that is their biggest need, but they need a first baseman too. And if they can find one on the trade market, I think they're going to go after it.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting trade deadline generally, but also an interesting first base market. You know, we thought maybe Pete Alonso would be available, and now the Mets are doing the same thing the Astros did and getting back in the mix here. You know, everything we've heard here is that it would take – quite a lot to get Vlad out of here at this point, and no one's off the table, but that's not, you know, when the Jays sell, it'll be more with an eye toward 2025 kind of thing. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see, and interesting to see if a team like the Astros gets a little desperate or a little needy there. Chandler Rome, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work.
Yeah, thank you.
Chandler Rome of The Athletic. Like I said, one of the best beat writers going. I love reading his stuff on a very, very interesting team that is now 43-41 and only three games out of a playoff spot because they've won 10 of their last 11. That's the thing you're allowed to do. If you start the season poorly, you can still turn it around. Even with a thinned out rotation, even with one of your best hitters on the IL, you can still do that. You're allowed. Yeah, maybe there's a gap in talent there between who the Astros have to kind of make that pushback and who the Blue Jays have. Although the Jays still have their rotation to lean on, including Jose Berríos tonight, who has a 3.38 ERA. That changeup has been unbelievable this year. 95th percentile off-speed run value. So that's you know, near the top among all pitchers in all of baseball. The slurvy curve is always there as well. Leaning on the sinker more instead of the four-seamer has been helpful for Berríos as well, because the four-seamer for the second year in a row has gotten teed off on pretty good. And because that changeup is so good, he's been a pretty split neutral guy this year. Righty's actually hitting a little better off of him than lefties are. Not that it particularly matters against an Astros team that skews pretty right heavy. I guess with switch hitters, they could put six lefties in the lineup today, but we're talking about, you know, the backup catcher and a couple bench guys that they don't really play that much anyway. This team's pretty, these are our eight guys that play every day, and then Trey Cabbage and Chaz McCormick platoon around that for the most part. So Jose Berríos, always a guy you want on the mound, coming off his highest strikeout outing of the year, where he struck out eight New York Yankees. Spencer Arrighetti is coming off his best start of the season, best start of his career, where he struck out 10 Colorado Rockies over seven shutout innings. Again, a bit of a weird guy to figure out. Has had some good outings against good teams, some bad outings against bad teams. He's a little all over the place. Another guy, get ready to hear the word extension again. He gets really far down the mound, even though he's only 6'2", and he'll work that 94-mile-an-hour four-seamer up in the zone, as well as a cutter. He'll work up and away. Should be a fun one tonight. Thank you to Chandler Rome, to Joe Siddle, to Robert Ford, to Julia Kreutz for joining us today. Thank you to Austin Mackey, Amit Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. It is Berríos and Arrighetti at 7 o'clock. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it down and set you up for the next one.